I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. After 8 years as a Kansas City councilman, Scott Wegner is unable to run for re-election, so he's turned his sights on succeeding the similarly term-limited mayor, Sly James. Today, a conversation with the mayoral candidate. Wegner has a plan for affordable housing in the city, and we'll ask him about that, along with getting his thoughts on violent crime and the new KCI terminal. Then, one of the busiest jazz artists is making his way to Kansas City. We'll talk with Grammy Award winner Kurt Elling about his vocal styles, the path he was going down before he found jazz, and where he honed his distinctive sound. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Councilman Scott Wegner is a lone Northland candidate in the race for Kansas City mayor, and that by itself makes him formidable. He's also the mayor pro tem on the city council, elected by his colleagues. And he's offered something that few have in this race, and that's an offer for an actual proposal to raise money for affordable housing, which has fast emerged as one of the hottest issues in this race. 11 candidates are running. Voters will send the top two finishers in the April primary to the general election in June. Councilman Scott Wegner joins me now. Welcome. Always good to have you.
Good morning. Staff. Thanks, Steve.
We'll talk about snow a little bit. We're at $20 million spent. What's this going to do to the city budget, Councilman?
Well, you know, this is part of the reason why you spend a lot of time building your reserve. Because back, you know, even when I started this, between the first term and second term, we talked a lot about building up that amount. The idea that you would have 2 months worth of reserves in the bank so that if something happened, you would be able to respond to it without cutting services. This was the first year that we actually reached that two-month objective, and I was happy to get that. And as chair of the Finance Committee, I was exceedingly happy to get to that because that was one of the things that I wanted to do as the committee chairman. So, you know, we build into the budget these things, and that's why we have these sorts of rainy day funds. But just to give you an idea, another metric to measure this year by, we finally used up the salt that we bought in 2016 this year, which suggests just how mild the last couple of years have been. And so as we talk about not only the snow, but the attendant potholes that come with it, we're going to fill them. It's just we would like to make sure that we have no more snow. So the springtime just can't come fast enough.
So when you say there's a reserve then, and we're talking about $20 million spent so far on removing snow in Kansas City, that suggests that current city services won't be impacted because you're able to pay for the snow removal through the reserve.
Right. I mean, that's the idea. So you've got within the budget various line items that affect everything from materials like salt to overtime and everything else. And so, you know, I wouldn't suggest that means we've got to take $20 million out of our reserve to go deal with this. Actually, we haven't been given what that number will ultimately be because, you know, we're not done with the weather quite yet. But what I would say is, you know, we spent a lot of time building up that reserve. So whether it is snow or whether it is something else, there is some cushion that we have built over time in our budget to take care of this. But you know, we're not raiding the piggy bank yet to pay for everything, because I think we have planned appropriately over the years as far as our budget is concerned and all the various line items. But it is significant, and there will be a hit you know, based on what has happened this winter, and hopefully next year will be a bit more mild.
Councilman Scott Wegner, a candidate for mayor, is my guest. You know, you've picked a tough race here, 11 candidates in this field. Why are you doing this to yourself?
You know, my wife asked me that when we decided to do this
maybe
a couple
once
of years
or twice,
ago.
Probably,
yeah. But, you know, I ran the first time back in 2011 because I was just a neighborhood president and thought I brought a perspective that no one else really had. And I think the work that I've done over the past 8 years have been reflective of that. But the reality is there is more to do, and we still have challenges, whether it is the issue of violent crime, whether that is the issue issue of workforce development and trying to get people out of unemployment and underemployment to take on the jobs that I think we would prefer to have here in this city, whether it's high tech, construction related, or many others. And I feel like, at the end of the day, though, I'm still that neighborhood guy. And that position and that perspective, I think, needs to be reflected in City Hall. But because of the knowledge that I have about the city's operation, because I am the finance chair, because I am mayor pro tem, I think I bring a unique perspective in getting us moving forward. And you know, we talk about momentum in this city, and I am sometimes mystified that, you know, why would you choose someone who wasn't there at the very beginning? I was. Mm-hmm. And I think that history, that perspective, that knowledge is a reason why I want to be the next mayor. And I think I can do it well.
You know, one of the issues you've been talking about is affordable housing. And it's obviously very high on the agenda right now. You actually have a proposal to address it and to actually finance at least a portion of it. What do you want to do?
Well, you know, to your point, we have talked about affordable housing, especially it started last year with the whole Cordish conversation. I mean, let's be honest, that's what really brought it to the front. And as people have lamented, well, we don't have a means to pay for it. And I'll remind everyone, back last term, and by last term, I mean in the 2011-2015 cycle, we were talking about building a $5 million fund, which nobody jumped onto, and there was really no funding source identified for that. We're now talking about a $75 million right. fund as part of our whole housing policy.
And no idea how to fund it.
And so, you know, I just go back to the point of, if it's important to this community will have to pay for it. Just as we said, infrastructure is important, so we're going to figure out a way to pay for it and tax ourselves to
right.
do it. To me, the affordable housing question is no different. And so what I put forward for consideration by our housing committee and by the council is to put forward a property tax raise of about $5 million. What that basically...
Pretty modest.
It is lower than what we have put out for the general obligation bond for infrastructure, just to give folks an idea. So $5 million raises you about $3.8 million a year. For someone who owns a $100,000 home, a $10,000 car, that equates to about $12 a year. Hmm. And the whole idea is to put forward a more equitable idea, not regressive as far as taxation is concerned. And there are those who are going to say, well, this is a tax and we don't want a tax. And I get that. And I understand that. And so my point in bringing it forward is to simply say, if this is really that important, that we really need a solution, then here is one. To at least get you to a point where the city can bring money forward so that as we may look at other sources of funding, that $75 million fund, we can say that the city is invested, and not just the city council is invested, but everybody is invested in this idea. And the language that I put forward would actually put it on the ballot in November of this year.
And how much support do you have for it?
Well, you know what? I think there are folks who are in the housing industry who are very much in favor of it. We're having this discussion now in our housing committee, and I've basically said, look, if there are alternatives that people can bring forward, I'm excited about them. Let's talk about them. I'm still waiting for those alternatives to come forward. Mm-hmm. The staff right now is tasked to kind of put forward their plan to come up with $75 million. But, you know, as I always point out, the average cost for the city to do multifamily affordable housing historically has been about $200,000 a unit. Mm-hmm. Historically, to do single family, that's been an investment of about $30,000 to $50,000 per unit. You know, saying it's affordable housing is actually kind of counterintuitive mm-hmm. because it costs money to produce that.
One question people might have is your proposal robust enough? Does it need to be even more? $3 million a year is better than nothing, but mm-hmm. it's a long way to get to $75 million in that trust fund that everybody's talking about.
Exactly. And so really the whole idea was to actually get a conversation started. And to start it with something that at the end of the day is not going to be a tremendous hardship, hopefully. Mm-hmm. But to your point, and I think you correctly point out, some may say, well, that's not enough. And if we totally rely on a tax to do it, then it's not going to be enough. if it is enough to get other private sources to actually step forward in this community, because again, historically they have not, then it may be enough. But I think at the end of the day, it just goes back to, you know, in politics, and you've covered this for years, Steve, you lament and wring your or gnash your teeth at certain issues, and then another issue comes down the line, and all of a sudden you forget what it was that you were arguing over in the first place, right? It is standard issue politics.
That's right.
From my point of view, I want to test how important this issue really is, and if it's important enough, then let's move forward. If it's not, we'll find out really quickly.
Do you favor this idea of requiring every developer, Scott, who gets a tax break on a new project to provide for affordable housing in some way, whether it's through setting aside units in that development or paying into a housing fund of some kind? Does that make sense?
Well, yeah. So we have had that discussion in the Housing Committee, and I was one of the co-sponsors of that ordinance. And the idea, again, goes back to what seemed to be the issues when Cordish came forward last year with Three Light, and this idea that, hey, you need to have some kind of workforce housing mixed in to everything that you're doing for, high rent sorts of projects. But I'll even use a different example. You know, we have worked very hard on the Paseo Gateway project. This is the replacement of housing for the old Choteau Courts. And the answer that we have been putting forward on that is not, let's just go build another 144 units. Rather, the idea has been around having mixed income. We do not want to just simply say that someone poor has to just live with other poor people. They have an opportunity for mixed housing opportunities. And so to your point and your question, if we are using public funds for a public good, then let's maximize the public good. And especially when it comes to where housing incentives have been used the most, and they have been used the most in the downtown area, there's no question about it, then there should be some thought to figuring out how can we expand the opportunity for housing at all incomes, knowing that at the end of the day, numbers have to work. And so what we're hopeful for is that putting some number or some percentage of those units in a more affordable category actually brings more of the workforce that you want to service the right area that they live in, and at the same time provides even more mix and choices when it comes to more affordable housing.
Scott Wagner is my guest. He's a candidate for Kansas City mayor. He's a councilman representing the Northland right now. The city, Scott, would look different as a result of a Mayor Scott Wagner administration. How?
I think it looks different because my focus is on the foundation of the city. And what I mean by that is you'll have transactions all day long. You will build another building. We're building an airport. We're expanding the streetcar. They're all transactions. But the things that underlie us, I think, are things like violent crime and finally coming to a more sustainable solution with that. It is preparing a workforce for the 21st century who can actually fill the jobs that we have today, whether it is in high tech, logistics, construction. When someone has a job, amazingly, they can invest in their home so their neighborhood looks better, and they can spend more money, which means that there are more choices for them in the neighborhoods that they live in. But the other thing, and it may seem counterintuitive to some folks too, is, you know, Kansas City is a global city. And I think part of the job of the mayor must be in recognizing that Kansas City is a global city. There are many times when I think we are called the best kept secret. And I know that there are folks out there who would like it to remain that way. But for us to grow, that secret has to be revealed to everyone.
Yeah.
And I have taken my hits over the years for participating in more international pursuits. But there's a method to that madness, because there are people around this world and even in this country who forget what Kansas City is, where we are, what we do, what makes us special. And I'd like to think in my past 8 years as a city councilman, I've been a pretty good salesman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you've talked also a minute ago about a sustainable path to resolve violent crime in this community.
Mm-hmm.
What is that path?
So it is a path that has many pieces to it. And if I were to simplify it, I'll simplify it this way. We have a lot of silos that do law enforcement in this town. You've got the police department. You've got preventative services like Aim for Peace. You've got the jail. You've got prosecution. And there is, I think, an opportunity to connect all those dots. And I don't think those dots have been connected effectively.
Wasn't the No Violence Alliance, Casey Nova, supposed to be just that?
So it is. That is an interesting comment, because as I talk in various forums and we talk about how if we had more housing, if we had more jobs, this and that, that the violent crime rate would go down. And there is some truth to that. But what I always point out is, you know, last year we had 130 homicides, the year before that, about 151. Back in the old days of 2013, it was 82. That was about the first year of Casey Nova actually being out there. 82. There weren't any more jobs. There wasn't any more affordable housing, yet that was the lowest number that we had in 30 years. And what I would suggest is that it went down to 82 because there were people out there who thought something is going to happen. And as a result, that homicide rate went down. When they found out, and what I say they, I mean the bad guys out there, when they figured out that, oh, wait a minute, nothing's going to necessarily happen to me, that number shot back up. And so that's why when I talk about these silos, it is
Casey Nova was hailed as this very effective program. It was wraparound services, helping offenders get jobs, potential offenders find employment, all those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. That's how it was hailed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a big believer in carrots and sticks. And if your sticks aren't very effective, then your carrots become less effective. Mm-hmm. And what I would suggest is all you have to do is just look at the current jail conversation. And I can tell you, as a former neighborhood president, one of the things that was drilled into me was what was referred to as the Matrix. And I don't mean a movie starring Keanu Reeves. Mm-hmm. What I mean is that when someone was coming to the jail, then there was a decision made as to who got released. And as we've talked about the capacity of the jail, and that has entered into the conversation, there is still a feeling, I believe, that's going on in neighborhoods today, especially in high crime neighborhoods, where when we ask them, come forward and tell us who the bad guys are, because they always know, they don't come forward, they don't report, because I believe they think that if they report and they think someone's going to jail, they're coming right back out, either because there's no room, or they're not sure that a case is actually going to be made.
So the solution to that is what then?
So the solution to that, I think, is, I'll put it this way. I'm not sure I have to wait. I can wait until I'm mayor of the city. But I think what has to happen is a conversation as to if there's not going to be a new jail in the future from the county, then it has to start with a conversation in the city. But again, it always boils back down to how do all these separate silos communicate? And I would say that, you know, the mayor has some, influence in this conversation, in that they are a member of the police board. They are, by virtue of being mayor, you oversee the health department, which oversees Aim for Peace. There is actually a violence-free Kansas City group that meets housed under the health department, which frankly has really not had an overly, let's say, time involvement from our current mayor. And that's not to say anything negative. It's just that's the case.
Right.
And so, you know, if it is a priority, then it must be clear that it's a priority, because it's something that you're dealing with every single
day.
But
hasn't the city made violent crime? Isn't it clear to everybody it's a priority?
Well, it always comes down to,
this town is just sort of floundering in this notion, you know, looking for new ideas, looking for a path forward. And maybe in fairness, there's not any great new solutions out there. We have to just keep doing and moving down the road as best we can. But the community is hungry to get this thing behind us, and we can't seem to get there. We have this talk year after year after year around here.
No, and your frustration is matched by myself and a whole lot of other people too. It was matched by people who participated in the violence task force that was done a couple of years ago, which a couple of my colleagues served on. And I would hear back from people involved as other committee members that we're really not getting anything done here. But I think what you've said is exactly the case. There is no new program that's going to save the city. There is no new thing that somehow is going to make things change. I'll say it this way. My youngest son is
but
in
people,
basketball.
I think the residents of the city, though, are saying they want this to change.
You're right. You're exactly right.
We've had enough of this. And as I talk to these different candidates, I'm just not hearing a path forward here
right.
that begins to sound like something a little bit new and different.
Right.
And again, in fairness, maybe it doesn't exist.
Well, I mean, what I was going to say is it's much like when my son practices basketball. You focus on the fundamentals. And the fundamentals here is showing every single day that violence is the thing that you want to deal with and that you want to bring the silos together. Here's an example. When it comes to Aim for Peace and some of the preventative programs that we have.
This is the group that goes out and tries to prevent mm-hmm. violence before it actually occurs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Someone gets murdered, they go out so that they don't take it out on someone
yes.
else, right?
Yeah.
Because again, everybody knows in those communities what's going on.
Yeah.
And the issue is, for example, that the police department and Aim for Peace really don't talk a whole lot.
No, they don't like each other.
They don't. And part of it has to do with their positions, the missions of both. But here's one example. Again, the mayor is one of the members of the Board of Police Commissioners. By virtue of being mayor, you have some oversight on the health department, which then runs the Aim for Peace program. The idea should be sitting down with both and figuring out how you have a path that can move forward together. It isn't a special program that goes on a banner. It isn't, it's the fundamentals.
What we got and making people
exactly.
come together. Do we need more officers in this community? Do we need to end state control of our police department? Would that make much of a difference?
On this question, I don't think the state control has anything to do with it, although I will tell
Others disagree with that.
Well, no, that's true. But what I'll tell you is if you try to jam them together like St. Louis did, you get disaster, which is what St. Louis is doing right now. It comes back to building trust. There are just on that little point, we have integrated our IT functions between the city and the police department. We are talking about other means of being able to integrate what the city does with the police department. And I would just simply say that unless you build trust because you can show that the city and department and the police department can work together, you can go try to somehow end local control, but it won't give you the results that I think everybody wants. But you ask also, is it about the manpower? Last year, we added 24 police officers. There is going to be a request that I expect to come from the department that we add 30. That's not in our submitted budget right now.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we added 24 last year and 15 call takers. Has that improved anything as far as the homicide rate? I don't know. But what it does suggest is there is a very much all over the city, a perceived feeling that it is less safe than it was.
Mm-hmm.
There are some numbers that depending on where you live may show that you're actually safer than you were
right.
A year ago, 5 years ago. But at the end of the day, there is an enforcement aspect of this because people expect when they call the police for the police to respond. Sure. There is a prevention aspect of this, which is where one may argue that there is not enough either for the social programs that are now running through the police department
mm-hmm.
or that are available through Aim for Peace, or that there's enough money for prevention programs, period.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, what I find is if you're going to solve an issue, you have to have the community that the issue is happening behind it.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be part of
and
the solution.
And that's not happening right
and
now.
And that's not happening. And I firmly believe that one of the reasons why is they feel like if they make a call, the person that is the problem isn't going anywhere. And in some cases, they may go to jail that night and they're right back out in their neighborhood the next day. And they feel like if I do that, they are going to come at me. And that's where you get into a jail conversation, a prosecution conversation. And that's a conversation that, frankly, can't wait till August 1st.
Right.
That has to be happening now.
Just give me real quick, your style of leadership would differ from Mayor Sly James's. How?
I think what I try to find is solutions that people that address the needs of other council members and other community members.
More collaborative?
More collaborative. I mean, I had to be collaborative to help get a sidewalk policy onto a general obligation bond.
Right.
I've had to be more collaborative to get the Buck O'Neill Bridge funding as part of our last PIAC renewal.
Yeah.
You know, everything that I've done, I think, has been, and I think I've had quite a good list of things that I've accomplished over the last 8 years, but all of it comes from working with people. And I think as mayor, my job is to figure out what is the objective of each council person coming into office, whether that's for their second term or for their first, because no one runs just to run. At least I don't think so. I've never,
right.
You know, people, there are things that people want to accomplish. And I think my job as mayor is to figure out what it is that they want to accomplish and understand that very early. So whether that is something that it kind of works into what I'm trying to do, then we can make it happen together. If they have an idea that I can help them with, then I can help them succeed as well. I think, you know, I have learned my lesson from the first term to the second that not every council person is the same. You got to meet them where they're at.
That's Councilman Scott Wagner. He's a candidate for Kansas City mayor. Thank you for sharing your views, Scott. Appreciate it. Stay safe out in the trail, okay?
Thank you very much.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with one of the preeminent jazz vocalists of our time. That's Kurt Elling. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, our media critics examined the recent controversy with a former Kansas City Star columnist and the blurring lines between fact and opinion in the news. You can hear what they had to say at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we talk with a former UMKC basketball superstar. We'll ask him about life after college hoops and how it felt having his college jersey number retired. Well, the New York Times calls Kurt Elling the standout male vocalist of our time, and you're about to find out why. He'll be at the Folly Theater on March 9th. This is one of my favorite Kurt Elling tracks. It's Leaving Again from his 2007 disc, Night Moves.
Sleeping, waking, it's morning, I have to go.
He's a Grammy winner and a 12-time Grammy nominee. Kurt was named Male Singer of the Year by the Downbeat Critics Poll for, get this, 14 consecutive years, and by the Jazz Journalists Association on 8 occasions. The Washington Post said this, since the mid-1990s, no singer in jazz has been as daring, dynamic, or as interesting as Kurt Elling. Amen to that. Again, he performs at 8, coming up on March 9th at the Folly. Kurt Elling joins us from the studios of WBGO in Newark, New Jersey. Kurt, what an honor. Nice to have you here.
Thank you so much, Steve. I'm happy to be with you.
Now, I got bad news for you. When I sing that song in the shower, and I've been doing it for about 10 years, I think I'm getting better, and I think I'm creeping up on you here, Kurt. There are times when I think I might actually be as good as you. Don't look behind.
I'll leave that to you and whatever other items you might have close to you in the shower to decide whether that's true. But I encourage you to keep singing.
Yes. Well, the opening to that song is just so damn exquisite. I mean, 15 seconds in, you rise up and sing, Leaving Again, It's Morning, and I Hate to Go. and it's pretty clear that you really don't want to go. I hope that's a feeling that everybody listening has had at some point in their lives. And can you give me a sense how you approach a song like that?
Well, as always, I try to, transmit or broadcast as much of the emotion of the lyric and the melody that I can. I feel fortunate that I'm a singer and not an instrumentalist as such, because it's so, I would think, it seems to me, and I've talked to cats about it, it's so much more difficult to wring emotion from an inanimate object. And the human voice is meant and built to transmit emotion and to transmit meaning and to broadcast feelings. So I'm lucky because I'm more than halfway there. Then the challenge is to, you know, do that and sing in tune at the same time.
Yes. Well, rate the opening passage from that song we just heard on a scale of difficulty. How tough is something like that for you?
Oh, man, the ballads, every different kind of composition requires a different technique, expertise. And it's a question of how tired I am on a given day or what have you. But, I don't really think of things in terms of level of difficulty as much as I focus equally on the task that's in front of me.
Right, right.
And try to do the best that I can with what the task is.
You know, it just strikes me, people are watching you when you're on stage so intently, listening to you just as hard, and man, you've got to sell it song after song. Some people might conclude that's a whole lot of pressure, Kurt.
Well, I mean, it's my job.
Okay.
It's my vocation. I don't think of it as pressure. I think of it as a pleasure. It's a challenge. It's a challenge to energy management. It's a challenge on my focus. But it's what I'm here to do. And there are certainly, there are tasks I could think of right offhand that are more challenging.
Like
than
what?
Singing for people.
Really?
Oh, balancing a checkbook. completing tax forms.
Yes, well, I agree with
anything
that.
Anything to do with, college entrance exams. I mean, there's all kinds of things I can think of right offhand that would make it more difficult for me. You know, operating heavy machinery, God only knows.
Yeah.
I really am only qualified for the one task in this life.
Did I read that you were headed into academia before you discovered jazz? I mean, what were you planning on doing in academia?
Well, I came from church people, and my father was very pious and very sincere and very loving and kind in his disposition. And the example that he set as a professional musician in the church was exemplary and was very magnetic. But I, in my heart, did not feel drawn to that kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I felt that I had to kind of justify any other choice. And I did want to have what you might think of as a map or a history of the strongest thinkers in the realm of philosophy and in the realm of reality. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to understand as much as I could, or at least come to a kind of agreement with life of what I thought about things. And of course, that continues to be in progress, but at the time I needed to take it seriously enough that I attended the University of Chicago Divinity School for 3 years and got my master's degree in the philosophy of religion. And you know, I don't really have necessarily any more answers than I would have otherwise, answers being very difficult to come by in this life.
Right.
When it comes to ultimate nobody, no matter who you ask, nobody's been dead and come back from it, not in a real sense.
Yeah.
And I think our time here is what we make of it, and making the most of the gifts that we've been giving and trying to show compassion and understanding and failing, but then learning from our failures and moving on and, you know, giving all that we can to each other.
So how did a guy from divinity school then find jazz, Kurt?
Well, jazz is not that far away. I mean, jazz as a genre and as an exploration of sound is inherently a spiritual exploration. Mm. And it's inherently a broadcast of the soul. It's a communal event. It is an event in which one soul broadcasts and tries to communicate and have that communication mirrored back. You know, you and I could probably list, without even thinking about it, 10 or 15 different musicians right. whose work are or have been explicitly spiritual, or who came from spiritual people. And whether or not that was explicitly delineated, or whether it was just part and parcel of the information provided, it's in there, and it's the deepest, heaviest part of things. It is what musicians, I believe, you know, commonly call the vibe.
Yeah, yeah. The great Kurt Elling performs at the Folly Theater on March 9th. For tickets, follytheater.org. You know, you developed what some regard as this idiosyncratic sound at the small clubs in Chicago where you used to work, maybe especially the Green Mill. You know, a lot of the jazz greats say they needed time to work out their stuff in the smaller clubs. Why was that time so important to you? Did the same apply to you there?
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Yeah.
And I wish I still had access to that, because I still have so much to work out, and I don't, you know, other than doing concert dates, when you're certainly incrementally moving forward as a creative artist, it's not the same thing as, you know, total experimentation and, you know, wide open freewheeling. God only knows what's going to happen next.
Right.
Just to continue to work on the skill set is so important. There, you know, I can certainly hear, thank goodness, when I listen back to early recordings, I can hear the things that I didn't know then
right.
about music
sure.
and about performing. I can hear the things that I know now. And it can be very difficult indeed to listen back to some of that early stuff. But my hope is, and I think it's a positive experience, because my hope is that here I am 52, it's been 25 years I've been on the road, so in another 25 years, I hope I can listen back to the things I'm doing now that people are receiving kindly, that
right.
I believe in, and I can say, holy cow, I wish I would have known then what I know now.
Right, right.
And to
right.
hear progress in my sound, and to deepen my experience, and to deepen the experience of my audience, it's a lifelong task, and there's a reason that jazz musicians revere our elders, and that we return to them over and over again, and that we want to spend time with them and listen to them. It's the reason I wanted to hang out with John Hendricks as much as I could mm-hmm. and Mark Murphy as much as I could. It's the reason why I still seek out Andy Bay. It's the reason why I want to be around those who have that much more experience, because they know more than I do, and I want to have all that.
When I talk about idiosyncratic, this is what I'm talking about. This is Downtown. We're going to go back a few years here, Kurt, from the disc Live in Chicago. This is from 2000. Kurt Elling.
We do welcome you to the Green Mill, where your dollar buys you more. We do hope that you have a excellent and groovy time hanging out with us this evening. Everybody sing along now.
Now, Kurt, who's credited with developing that scatting style of singing? That goes back in the tradition a long ways. Who's credited with that?
Well, I mean, Louis Armstrong
okay.
Really is the root. Legendarily, he dropped the music, or it fell off of his music stand, and he just kept on singing.
That's a debatable
story, but it's a lovely apocryphal one.
Yes,
and it became one of his first big hit numbers. But I mean, you know, to approach the art of singing with an instrumentalist's or a compositional mindset, is one of the hallmarks of jazz. And some of the greatest, not every jazz singer is a scatting artist. Nancy Wilson's birthday today, not a scatter, no less a jazz singer. Shirley Horn, almost no scatting, definitively a jazz singer. But the cats who I have followed, we spoke before about Mark Murphy and John Hendricks. Right. There's also Dave Lambert, Eddie Jefferson. And then you come from the other side, people like Dizzy Gillespie, who could scat up a storm. And thank goodness he tried. He didn't have to make a living from it, because he could scat rings around just about anybody. You know, I've heard Wynton Marsalis scat, and he could crush me in a heartbeat.
No
and
kidding.
So I try not to scat when he decides he's going to do any kind of singing at all.
Remember Clark Terry? Clark Terry used to do that mumbles thing. It was always
exactly
so fun.
So.
Yeah.
So you know, it's one of the arrows in the arsenal that a jazz singer can pull out. I try not to overuse it, but it's definitely a fun time, and I think people tend to enjoy it. I certainly have been trying to get better and better at it over the years, and.
Well,
that's
in your shows, you've been known to scat, you've been known to do poetry, you've been known to do readings. What determines what you're going to do on any given night?
Well, the project at hand is really what does it. If we've made a recording or have a theme or there's a special occasion or there's just something on my mind, then I'll pull that out at the last minute. Or if I feel that the audience needs to have a little message of something. You know, these days we're so much in conflict with one another, and I really do feel like I need to address this moment in time. My most recent recording, The Questions, is certainly my attempt at a humane response to the challenges that are besetting our nation and our communities and the world. And so I'll say some things about that that I hope are inclusive and welcoming to all, but also express clearly my attitude toward things so that I can make sure that I'm encouraging the best in people who come out to hear the music, that I'm encouraging everybody to feel a little bit better and maybe changing a mind or two through my words and actions and the music.
And I wanted to ask you this. You know, at some point in your career early on, you sent a demo to Blue Note. That's, you know, the preeminent jazz label. And you got signed to the label. From my vantage point, that seemed to happen with jet speed. Was it really that easy? You sent the demo, you got the contract, off you went? Or am I missing some chapters there?
It happened pretty quickly.
I mean, good for you.
We made the demo in Chicago. We had 9 tunes, and we, you know, did our best with it. And I went into debt. We made it for about $10,000, and I put it all on a credit card.
No kidding.
And we had a little cassette, and I was sending it around. And a friend in Chicago connected me with a manager out in L.A. who ended up being my very dear friend and manager for 10 years or so. And he was straight away ready to shop the record, as we used to say in those days. And we did get it to Bruce Lundvall. And Bruce Lundvall was extremely excited about it. God bless him. And he gave me a shout. And I think within 4 months of him hearing the initial demo tape, I was signed. And we were recording, you know, 3 or 4 more numbers to fill out a CD length project. And that, you know, so basically they licensed my demo, we put that out, and then that was nominated for my first Grammy Award.
It's not supposed to be that easy, Kurt.
Well, it's a quick trip is not necessarily an easy trip. There was quite a lot of stress.
That's fair.
And I you know, looking back, I feel definitively underqualified at that moment of my life. And it's obviously been a blessing and welcome.
Well, Blue Note changed your life, right?
Blue Note changed my life. The opportunity to tour straight away changed my life. I mean, it really was my heart's desire, and there it was right in front of me. So, you know, from that point on, it's been my task to be faithful and to be grateful and to use the opportunities that have come my way to learn as much as I can, sing as well as I can, and perform as as beautifully as I can with the best musicians I can afford that I can draw to myself for the audiences who trust me by coming out to concerts.
Right. Let's play just a bit more from Kurt Elling here. This is There's a Boat That's Leaving Soon for New York from the Branford Marcellus Quartet album. It's titled Upward Spiral.
There's a boat that's leaving soon for New York. Come with me. That's where you belong, sister. You and me can live the high life in New York. Come with me. There you can't go wrong, sister. I'll buy you the swellest mansion way up Fifth Avenue. And tomorrow we'll go strutting, and there'll be nothing too good for you. I'll dress you in silk and satin in the latest Paris style. And the blues you'll be forgetting, and there'll be nothing for you but smiles. There's a boat that's leaving soon for New York. Come with me, that's where you belong, sister. That's where you belong.
You know, you've clearly got something going with Branford Marcellus. You've worked with him any number of times, Kurt. How did that partnership come about?
Well, I'm happy to say Branford gave me a call. We had glancingly known each other through the years, meeting up at various jazz festivals and music festivals backstage and saying hello. And he would consistently say, man, making a record with you. And sure, man, anytime. Huh. And then he actually, you know, phoned me up and said, are you all right? Are you ready? And I said, I don't know if I'm ready, but I'll give it my best shot. And he was uniformly gracious, kind, encouraging, instructive. What can I say? He's the kind of band leader that you actually are ready, that you desire to follow. Huh. It's definitive. It's incredibly high quality. The experience is going to challenge you on just about every level. And he loves his band and takes care of the band. And he included me, you know, as a member of his band. I would say, man, thanks for having me guest with you. He's like, guest? You're in the band, dude. I don't know what you're talking about.
You know, we just have a minute left. You know, next month at Jazz at Lincoln Center in New York, you're doing something called Kurt Elling's The Big Blind, a jazz radio drama. That's near and dear to a radio person's heart. What are you doing there?
Well, it's an old-time radio-style drama with music.
Yeah.
And it's a noir fantasy that will star Dee Dee Bridgewater, and Ben Vereen and myself and a couple of other lovely, wonderful singers who are actors. And Guy Barker from the UK has come over. He's written an incredible score for a 23-piece orchestra. And we're going to have a sound effects artist, and it's just going to be a thrill. It's March 1 and 2 at Jazz at Lincoln Center. And it will be webcast live on the second night, which is March the 2. So if people can't be there in person, you can experience it just as it was intended. You can close your eyes or you can watch it happen. It's going to be a thrill.
Wow, that's great. That's Kurt Elling. He performs at the Folly Theater on March 9th. For tickets, follytheater.org. His latest CD project, it's called The Questions. There's a live version and a studio version. Kurt, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you so much, Steve.
You bet. Tomorrow on the show, we look at the challenge of finding a job that won't succumb to automation. It's the college economy tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.
That you need her today. Most girls rely on a message. Some text or tweet. One call can give.